Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The coronavirus death toll in the United States is approaching 220,000 as daily cases hit new levels not seen since July. Stimulus talks in Washington have turned chaotic, and much, much more. Joining us now to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in sunny Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome back to the podcast.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, always good to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Highlight of my weekend, Vago. Thank you.
Same here. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA is sponsoring our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS are also sponsoring our Association of the United States Army's AUSA Now virtual coverage of their annual meeting. All right, guys, bumpy week, chaotic stimulus negotiations, as I mentioned at the top of the show. Coronavirus cases are soaring. The president is at odds with his own party. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin has said that a deal before the election is unlikely. That's about 16 days away, if my math holds correctly. But he's still in conversations with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The two of them had a call this weekend. British Airways CEO Alex Cruz has been fired, replaced by Sean Doyle of Aer Lingus. Air Canada's Calin Rovinescu is retiring. He's going to be replaced by Michael Rousseau. Great New York Times story on how United is navigating the pandemic. But, you know, they reported earnings down nearly 80% from the 2019 quarter. It was a $1.8 billion third quarter loss. American and Delta reported as well. Good news, U.S. Transportation Command has concluded there's a low risk of aerosolized COVID exposure for DOD families and dependents flying on contracted 777 and 767 airplanes. Good news, EASA has approved 737 MAX before FAA did, and Europe's WTO sanctions have gotten approved. Now, Europe can sanction America as America is sanctioning Europe. Ron, start us off. Wherever you want to start eating this elephant from, and you know whether the street is still hopeful there is going to be a deal, what the rising cases mean, and whatever's on your mind to start us off, and then go to Sash and then go to Richard as we dig our way through all this.
Yeah, I mean, it was a choppy week in the market too. I mean, in particular for aerospace and defense. Broadly, you know, the client base that I talk to is pretty much disinterested in both commercial and defense at the moment. Commercial, I think a lot of folks just sort of written it off for dead for a while. My sense at some point, folks might want to get back into it, but nobody's in a rush. And then on defense, just given the upcoming election, I don't think anybody sees that there's a rush to get into defense before the election, and they want to see some of that settle out. Now, that said, as you mentioned, United and Delta both reported this week. You know, some of the
did American report, or was I mistaken on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think American did. I think it was United and Delta. But you've got United. Probably the bigger takeaway for them was, I mean, they're looking at corporate traffic being down 85% to 90%, and you just kind of ballpark. You know, what the corporate is to the airlines, it's something like a ballpark a third of their volume, but it's like two thirds of their profit. So having not having corporate travel, that's impactful to most airlines. You know, Delta on their call talked about, you know, they're going to take out 60% of capacity in the fourth quarter. United's going to take out 55% of capacity in the fourth quarter. Delta talked about their CapEx plan. They took $2 billion out this year. They're going to take $5 billion out between to 2022. Delta's going to retire 400 airplanes. That's 25% of their fleet. We did a call this week with IATA, and you know the IATA numbers are kind of what they are, right? I mean, 2020 down 68% on air traffic, and I think this was kind of telling. Kind of two statistics they talked about. is, you know, 2021, they're looking for air traffic to be 60 to 65% of 2019. That's not great, right? And then if the current cash burn rate at the world's airlines continues, the world's airlines have about 8.5 months of cash left, right? So, you know, the quote of the week for me that jumped out was Steve Hazy did a webinar. I think it was with Aviation Week, whoever, it doesn't matter. But his quote from that was, for me, you know, we have to be optimistic, otherwise it's too easy to get depressed. And even he, who tends to be generally optimistic, admitted that what they were thinking, how the recovery would play out, is playing out much slower than they thought. And that's getting reflected in the market for the stocks. You know, the news broke that EASA, you know, was looking favorably at the MAX relative to the market. I think Boeing was up 1% when it was all said and done, right? So, you know, the level of kind of throwing in the towel on commercial is pretty high at the moment.
Sash, give us, and I should say that Nancy Pelosi is also saying that time is running out to get a bill passed, obviously, because of the legislative calendar. Sash, talk to us a little bit, right? Cases are surging. New lockdowns are in place in France, not any more popular in France than they are in the UK as well. Talk to us about what you see that picture. There was a great New York Times story about how United is, you know, profiling United and how they plan to weather it. And as Ron said, 2022 is their earliest in, you know, when we start recovering. How do you sense this third wave of cases affecting what our prognosis should be? I mean, does it confirm the thesis, or do you have any new thoughts about where we're going to end up?
Short answer, it doesn't change our thesis, because we have been much more bearish about the impact of COVID on the civil aviation industry than I think some observers, present company, accepted. We personally don't think this is about a vaccine, except in the very, very long term. What this is about is the fact that as countries lock down either parts or whole of the countries, if you're trying to fly remotely internationally and at the other end of your flight, or indeed at both ends of your flight, you have to take a 2-week quarantine, you're not going to do the flight. Right. And therefore, international travel, which is far more important for airlines outside the US than it is inside, although clearly it's very important for the profits of the US big three, because that's a big chunk of business traffic. But airlines outside the US that are flying internationally are seeing their traffic down typically 85% plus, but if you look at the statistics in the last week, US was up, but actually Europe is just slipping back again. And it's slipping back because, as you said, France is getting about 30,000 new coronavirus cases a day. The UK is up, bouncing around the 20,000 level. Italy around 11,000. And these are causing progressive lockdowns of parts of the country and, restrictions. And it's, this is going to take a very, very long time to work through, to a stage where people can do what we did even 9 months ago, which was in a very carefree way, think, I'm going to go away for the weekend, book a ticket, go to the airport, get on the plane, do what you want to do and then come back again. That sort of attitude to flying has been damaged for probably another year or so to come. And this is going to feed through to whether airlines survive or not. And more will not survive in their current form than will. And those that do, how many of them are really going to want to take new aircraft? I mean, Airbus is forcing aircraft on airlines. They're saying, you have a contract, you take the aircraft, just so leasing companies. I think there's only a degree, certain stage to which you can do that before you actually start damaging your customers, because they can't afford to take these aircraft and they've got nothing to do with them.
Does the U.S. Transportation Command study change anybody's thesis at all? Does it change your thesis? I mean, it pretty much, right? I mean, Ron, we've talked about this in weeks past as well, right? I mean, so just really quickly, does it change how any of you look at what the outlook for the market is at all?
For myself, no, not really. Largely because one of the biggest barriers are the quarantine constraints. And I mean, domestically, even in the US, we've got the quarantine constraints between states, which can be taken I don't know, I guess it's, there's individuals take it serious, some folks don't, but I mean, for sure that's impacting domestic travel. And then the international quarantine constraints, which are taken far more seriously on every level, are, you know, an issue for travel, right? So for me to do, you know, a business trip to London and have to quarantine for 2 weeks, it just makes it untenable. So until, you know, the global quarantines are on some level that it makes it palatable, it's going to be a big issue. And then on top of it, how, and this is one of the bigger debates, I think, that's going on among investors and maybe even in the broader community that looks at all this, is, you know, what is the future of business travel after this? You know, does business travel return to where it was, which is the camp I actually fall in? But there's a lot of people who believe that that won't be the case. And we're seeing some sort of secular shift in business travel. So there's a ton of moving parts. So does that one thing change my outlook? No, it doesn't.
Richard, what's your sense on all of this?
You know, I think a lot of people have been placing a bet that things would recover in a V-shaped way, and that's been the situation, you know, for quite some time, or was the situation for quite some time. I think it's definitively ended, but that means everyone keeping capacity in place. That means lots of lessors and financiers doing deals with the expectation that airlines would simply take planes, as Ron said, and of course that if they allowed for a couple of lease holidays, lease deferrals, then it would all be made good over the following year. And it's pretty clear that in many key metrics, particularly international traffic, we're just not going to see any kind of meaningful recovery until the vaccine in the second half of next year. So this is going to get messy, particularly with production rates. You know, I mean, especially on Twin Isles, because everyone has been maintaining this sort of, six per month here, five per month there mantra, with the expectation of this kind of V-shaped recovery. And I just don't think it's proving realistic.
I should say that Sash was the one who was telling us that it was going to be more like the Nike swoosh, right? Deep, fast down, slow recovery. Go ahead.
Well,
yeah, so just adding to Richard's comments, if you look at the 787s that have been delivered and the 787s that Boeing has in inventory, and you just kind of go through a quick scenario analysis, it's very possible they could end the year with 50 to 60 787s in inventory. That's a lot of large airplanes. Just to remind everyone, if you go back to the 787 crisis way back when, at that point, I think they had 80 of them in inventory. So you're starting to approach levels that, you know, were, you know, last time we saw this is when, you know, the 787 was grounded and they had those issues. That's just a lot of airplanes on top of all the 737s they'll have in inventory. So it's a lot of working capital, and it's a lot of aircraft. More importantly, it's a lot of aircraft that have to enter back into the fleet on top of airplanes that, you know, are already in the fleet, right? So it's a tough spot. So it seems like a V-shaped recovery is, incontrovertibly out the door at this point.
Actually, if I could sort of follow on with alphanumeric metaphors, sure. Here, it seems that the concept, probably the most dismal contribution to the world of these metaphors from this downturn is the K shape. And I think there are many parts of the economy where the K shape is manifesting itself, you know, wealthier people going up, and, whereas a very large percentage of the population heading down. And I think you might just be seeing this over the coming year with domestic travel making some kind of recovery, and then international travel just continuing in the sort of the downward part of that K. As Ron said, it's really not about people's willingness to fly on planes. It's just the quarantine restrictions. That doesn't look like it's going to change anytime soon. Looking at what's happening in the U.S., they don't discriminate on the basis of states. We live in D.C., Vago, and things are fine here from the standpoint of going to Germany or something, but the Germans see us exactly the same as they see a North Dakotan. That isn't good. So the odds are that we're not going to see that kind of international market recovery.
If I can just add one last thing on this. It's been very interesting. There's been quite a lot of coverage and debate in the UK media this week of what happens when we get a virus, and the chief medical officer is beginning to be, more optimistic. Oh, sorry, not a virus, a vaccine. We've already got the virus, but the vaccine. And the chief medical officer is becoming more optimistic about the prospect for at least one of the vaccines. And the UK, remember, has bought six different sorts of vaccines. So, you know, we're going to be awash with the stuff. He's optimistic, you know, there is going to be something available by the beginning of next year. But then what they say is the rollout is going to be the very old, the very vulnerable first, and working its way down the age, you know, gradient. And probably at the end of all of this, only 50% of the UK population will be vaccinated. So none of the children will be, and very, very few of the teens, 20s and early 30s will be. You know, because they probably don't need it. They're not a high priority. And then we'd be better off as a nation keeping on giving it to the, you know, the elderly, middle aged and so forth. So vaccine, everybody says it's going to be fantastic. And I mean, our view is when a vaccine is approved and starts being issued, stock markets will go up massively. But it's not going to restore international travel, because having had a vaccine is not going to be enough. And not everybody will get that vaccine.
Richard, let me go to you and ask you about the 737 MAX. Were you surprised that EASA came through with the approval for the design changes to return to flight before the FAA did it?
No, not at all. You know, I mean, I think one of the more less appealing aspects of the return to service has been the impugning of the Europeans and other international carriers, is that they would somehow be a little bit biased against the U.S. for reasons of, you know, vengeance, or reasons of the trade issues, or being anti-Trump or whatever else. You know, these people are aviation professionals. They should have always been assumed to be aviation professionals. They did their job. They did it very well. The one caveat that they had about the sensor, third sensor, they had very reasonable demands about a retrofit program. I think they did a terrific job, and they should have always been assumed to be the kind of professionals who do a job this way. So I'm happy to see it, but not terribly surprised.
Sash, let me bring you in, as I think asking you a Brexit question would be utterly fruitless. Let's talk about Europe's WTO sanctions instead, because I don't think on that other issue there's anything that affects our corner of the universe like this WTO case does, right? The United States had imposed sanctions on Europe, claiming that it had won. Now Europe is saying that it's won and it's allowed to slap sanctions on the United States. So where do we go?
Yeah. Next? Okay. I'm first. Thanks for the pass on Brexit. That's appreciated. Europe isn't actually saying they've won, but what they're saying is the US judgment US got the judgment first, and the US fines are 80% higher than the European fines, but Europe has now got the ability to, my words, not anybody in Europe, to retaliate and impose $4 billion of sanctions on the US, having, you know, had US sanctions on European goods, not just aircraft, for the last, you know, 6+ months. What I think is going to be really interesting about this, there was a hope that once both sides had a WTO judgment in their pocket, they would be able to come together and say, okay, well now let's call it quits and do a deal. And the US approach,
which is what the Europeans proposed, right? Hey, look, yeah, guys, come on, this is a zero sum game. Let's figure out rules and just get on with it.
Yeah. And also, you know, by the way, if you haven't noticed, the big issue is going to be China, because anybody who thinks that the Chinese are not going to subsidize their way to at least number two position in the global aviation industry at some stage in the next couple of decades or so is deluded. But anyway, the US and Europe are going to keep on playing this utterly stupid game. I would just raise one issue here, which is that, you know, the US has put sanctions on Airbus. Yeah, fair dues, you know, that's what it's about. But it has also spread the sanctions quite widely. So, for example, there's sanctions on exports of Scotch whiskey to the US. Your loss, not ours. I do wonder, though, whether the Europe with sort of less powder is going to focus on Boeing only. And, you know, remember that Europe can impose sanctions on the 737 MAX deliveries to Ryanair in Ireland and elsewhere. And that would take one of the only really financially secure, stable, super aggressive buyers of narrow body aircraft out of the Boeing customer list for a while, or at least it would price them out. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that happened, because I think tempers are so thin at the moment. Watch this space.
Ron, you've got to go in a minute, so let me get your sense on the WTO case. And also queue up word that Boeing may be vacating its Long Acres headquarters for the commercial airplanes from Renton. The unit's CEO, Stan Deal, saying that he's considering being much more mobile. He wants him and his executives to be closer to where the product is. There's some talk about relocating some folks to Everett. We don't need to plant a flag for everybody in the Pacific Northwest. There's this sense that that just puts everybody one step closer to Boeing backing out of the region in the wake of the Charleston decision. So talk to us about sort of the WTO decision and your sense on this Boeing decision, because I think the consensus is we will work more flexibly, but you still need sort of some form of headquarters. And I think people got worried when the phrase, we don't need to plant a flag, kind of maybe stressed people out a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, a couple thoughts on this. So on the WTO, I don't think anybody was or should have been very surprised about that. And in fact, we didn't see much of a reaction in the market. So I think that's just kind of where the market's head was, because we've seen so much of this back and forth. And anybody who's looking at the space should have known that was in the cards somewhere. On the closing of the Boeing headquarters facility and the mobility of management, I think Boeing is in cost-cutting mode, right? So this would be a way to A, cut cost, B, what's the name of the campus, Richard?
Long Acres.
Long Acres is a big campus. It's a lot of land in a part of the world where land isn't cheap. So they might be able to raise some capital by actually selling the complex. So I understand that. The part that's more tricky, and this, I guess you could argue, was self-inflicted by moving your production around the country and now having a base, a solid, it wasn't solid before, but having 787 production in one part of the world and everything else in another part of the world, and you're going to try to spread your management around. I think that in and of itself will be hard to manage. One, two, it's also, I think, very difficult to innovate remotely, right? I mean, a lot of the process of innovation really is discussions around the water cooler, if you will, and not having that, particularly in a manufacturing business. Getting people to be innovative in manufacturing processes, being innovative around product, that kind of thing. I personally think strongly that that's very, very difficult to do in Brady Bunch style on a Zoom call. I'm clearly not optimistic about it, but I understand why they are pursuing it. Desperate times require desperate actions. And I think right now for the Boeing company, this is desperate times.
Let me ask one follow-up question to that. Companies that get into desperate times have a tendency of making really, really not just a bad decision, but a string of bad decisions. One of the terrifying points that Sash made a very long time ago is, no company has ever recovered when the sort of 50-50 moves to 60-40, moves to 65-35, it becomes unrecoverable. Obviously, the pandemic has intervened here a little bit and reset the scales. But, right, I mean, I remember Lockheed was reusing printer cartridges and burning out really expensive printers, right? So it was saving money on one end, but it ended up actually incurring a lot of cost across its businesses by doing that, right? I mean, that was just a little thing. There were also bigger things in the late 1990s and early 2000s when that happened, as I recall. I mean, is there any sense, is there a concern by investors and analysts like you that actually we might end up not cutting cost, but actually cutting into bone, muscle and bone?
Clearly, that's always a concern. I've fielded calls with investors who are worried about that. You know, what is the long-term future of the company? Do I think anybody is worried about the short to medium term? No, I mean, they'll get through that. But as you know, I mean, this is an industry where you make a decision today that you can live with for the next, or you're forced to live with for the next 20 to 30 years. It can have a very long impact. And I think that is creeping into the minds of investors of, okay, you know, what you do today will have a very, very long term impact. And, you know, ultimately I'm of the view, even in the current market conditions, that it would be in some ways smarter to raise more capital and do some more aggressive product development to assure your future. Because ultimately, right, if we're sitting here talking 5 years from now, probably things are a lot better. And having a new product in the market 5 years from now is going to be a really desirable thing. So the decision that you have to make today is, do you just sort of swallow hard and take the big pill and raise the capital today and do some product development and maybe upset some of your investors short term to assure the viability and success of the company for the much, much longer term. I think when you get into these situations where it's you're in survival mode and you're confronted with, and it's not an easy confrontation, you're confronted with, you know, by far and away an order of magnitude worse downturn than anybody's ever dreamed, to make those decisions. But I think that's where strong leadership comes in. And it's, you know, are you going to make the decisions today that put the company on good footing for not just the next 3 to 5 years, but for the next 100 years? And those are, I think, in situations like this, this is the kind of decisions that they're confronted with.
Yeah, here, here.
So do you want to, who wants to follow up on that before, in the couple of minutes we still have Ron with us before we move to the other big stories of the week?
You know, I think there are two possible paths for the company moving forward. One is the type of company that does indeed look to the future, raise more cash to invest in that future, and in the long run is rewarded. And the other is the kind of company that says, all right, the 737 was cash flow. When it gets turned back on again, we return that money to investors and get rich over the next 4 or 5 years. And after that, whatever. And increasingly, given the cuts they're making to engineering, given the cuts to new product development, given even possible cuts in, well, their headquarters, this is a company that's comporting itself like, well, a kind of company that's only concerned about turning on the great fuselage machine, bringing in cash flow, returning it to investors, and then worrying about, well, being a marginal player in jetliners in 5 years. I'm not at all pleased with the path they're on. I think they need better leadership.
Is this McDonnell Douglas-like in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's no question that, you know, McDonnell Douglas, of course, between 67 and 97 was on a 30-year trajectory. This looks a lot like the last 10 or dozen years of it.
Sash?
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm afraid you preempted me with McDonnell Douglas similarly. The only difference between Boeing and McDonnell Douglas at the moment is the 787. You know, the 737 is going the same way as the MD-80 series. It's a stretch too far. It's reducing to a single model that is remotely good, the Dash 8. And, you know, it's old technology and, you know, most people know that, and its passenger appeal or its airline appeal is diminishing. The 777 is going the same way as the MD-11 at the moment. It's got a slightly higher rate, but not a lot. You know, it's very, very similar in rates. So the only difference is the 787. The problem is the 787, the market for it is not strong enough to drag the rest of the company up at the moment. So what they've got to do, they've got to raise capital and they've got to spend it, for tomorrow. They've got to spend it on very aggressively on new products. Without that, it goes the same way as McDonnell Douglas. Nobody is owed a living in this industry. Chinese will come along quite happily and take up that number two position.
Ron, any last thought on that, on the McDonnell Douglas?
Yeah, simile? I mean, I think it's, you know, it's not an easy decision. I mean, the harder road is raising capital and making investment. The easier road is just cutting costs and, you know, trying to get through the current disruption. But you have to remember the current disruption isn't a forever disruption. And you have to plan for that, particularly in this industry. And for sure, 5 years from now, I don't see why not. And maybe people will disagree with me why air traffic won't be back on a similar trajectory that it was before. And how nice would it be to have a shiny new product to bring into the market against your major competitors globally, both across the Atlantic and across the Pacific at that time?
I would also point out that this future for some time is going to be heavily dominated by that middle market, by the single aisle middle market that Airbus is capturing. Boeing's strength, if you can call it that, the last strength they've got is with large twin aisles that it's going to take some time for the market to need. So basically, if they want a future that's beyond a 35% future, they really do need to make some kind of middle market investment.
One of the things I'm interested in getting your take on very, very briefly, because I think we should note it, Alex Cruz got fired at British Airways, being replaced by Sean Doyle of Aer Lingus, and then Calin Rovinescu, who did a tremendous job at Air Canada, is being replaced by Michael Rousseau, the CFO. Any sort of broader message here for you guys?
I would, I'll just start off. I mean, Alex Cruz took British Airways down market. He cut costs, and he cut costs where a lot of passengers perceive, you know, felt them. You know, the product got less good. The customer loyalty, customer loyalty is a very, very delicate thing. And he definitely strained customer loyalty. And in a downturn like this, managers, you know, the effect of management decisions like that start to be felt. And so, you know, alas, I don't think he's going to be missed by many of his customers or even many of his former colleagues either. I think we're going to see more airline management changes because the stress within the system or systems.
Ron, I know you've got to go. Thanks very much for joining us. Look forward to having you back on next week.
Thanks, Vago. Always a pleasure. Take care.
And anything to say about Air Canada, given that it's an airline that you and I, Richard, both have a soft spot for?
You know, I've always liked their international long-haul service. And I, you know, when eventually the market comes back, I think they'll do great. But, you know.
And it is also one of your favorite lounges in Toronto, isn't it?
They've got a sommelier. I mean, come on, you know, you go to you're used to the business lounges, you know, for United or American, and it's like, wow, this is premium mediocre, as somebody once put it. And then you go to the Air Canada lounge and it's just like, you've got a sommelier and he really knows what he's doing. That's just a huge pleasure. I love that.
I know we've talked about this with Ron. You know, it is quirky. It's quirky. It's Canadian and in a really good way. Okay, time is winding down and we've got a couple of big issues to talk about. Speaking of European woes, Leonardo chief executive, the widely respected Alessandro Profumo, has been found guilty by an Italian court of market rigging and false accounting in the first half of 2015 when he was the chief executive of one of Italy's oldest banks, Banca Monte di Paschi di Siena, otherwise known as BMPS, and was sentenced to 6 years in jail. There's a nearly $3 million fine and a ban of running a company for 2 years. However, he remains free while his case is on appeal. So it goes to one appeal, then it goes to Italy's Supreme Court, a process that can take very many years. And Leonardo has said that Profumo is going to stay on the job. Profumo became Leonardo's chief executive in 2017. And each of the last four Leonardo chief executives have faced legal actions. Mauro Moretti, Profumo's predecessor, once headed Italy's rail system. He was given a 7-year sentence for a deadly 2009 train wreck. His case remains on appeal. Giuseppe Orsi was accused of corruption in 2013 on the sale of helicopters to India. He was fully acquitted by the Supreme Court last year. And then Pier Francesco Gorgorlini, the legendary Finmeccanica chief executive, was accused of corruption, but also cleared about a year after those charges were raised. I think this comments more on the Italian legal system than anything else. Full disclosure, Leonardo DRS is one of our sponsors, and I've moderated panel discussions with Alessandro Profumo, and I've interviewed him before. Sash, what do you make of this?
I mean, look, who would be an Italian CEO? This, you know, I think you got it right. It's an incredibly politicized system, but it's also a system where the judiciary have a very, very aggressive attitude towards chief executives. Now, you might argue that's very good governance. You might argue that chief executives are, you know, are held to account for what goes on or might have gone on or is alleged to have gone on. But, you know, it's very hard to see why you would want to be a chief exec of any major Italian quoted company. And that ultimately is Italy's loss. You know, it is it will mean that more smart, bright people go into private markets, private equity and so forth, than go to the public markets. You know, as a Profumo, we share your very, very high regard for him. We think he's done a very, very good job with Leonardo. And we were encouraged, about 18 months ago when he had his term of office extended. Doesn't look like his term of office is going to be extended again in, I think it's either late 21 or early 22, just because once you've got this, this sentence hanging over you, even though the appeal will take years, because that's how the Italian legal system works, I think the government will just say we'll move on to somebody else. So what we have to hope, as you know, people who want Leonardo to succeed, is that it has a good bench of highly competent potential new CEOs who can take over. That's very, very sad, though, that we should be talking like this about, you know, a major national champion.
Do you think that there's any knock-on effect, right? Because Moretti was going to be extended, but the legal action knocked him out of contention. Giuseppe Orsi came in with an ambitious agenda as well. He was knocked out of action, right? Which is how Moretti got the job. I mean, at the end of the day, is, you know, how are markets looking at this in terms of aggregate impact on a company that is absolutely integral to the entire global, both aerospace and defense ecosystems?
The Leonardo share price is on its back. Leonardo is predominantly a defense company with some civil aeronautics, roughly 80-20. We can quibble over 5% in either direction. But, you know, even if it's 75-25, it's predominantly a defense business. But the share price down at €4.50 is saying this is either a civil aerospace business, which is, you know, it's in an existential crisis, like Spirit or someone like that, or it's saying that the Italian discount, because you have to put a big discount on a company where CEOs don't stay for long enough to actually get their restructuring and their reform and their strategic objectives through, the Italian discount has to widen. That's very, very sad. We personally think share price is wrong. We've got a very strong buy recommendation on the stock, but events like this just don't help.
Richard, let me bring you in. A little bit of an interesting dynamic going on. Dassault Aviation, the maker of the Rafale jet and some of the world's popular Falcon series of business jets, is a strong-willed company, I think would be a modest understatement. And they are resisting pressure from both the French defense minister, Florence Parly, and the chief of the defense staff, about not raising Rafale production rates. What's this all about?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of fascinating from an American perspective. You know, we're obviously in an industry and an economic system where there's tremendous pressure to push metal out the door, bring in cash while you can, worry about overcapacity later, and whatever else. And they're far more disciplined. They, you know, I mean, I guess they're intent on building jet fighters the way Britain makes sitcoms. You know, it's like, the longest running program ever, and we've got all 20 episodes. You know, it's a completely different philosophy. And, you know, demand for many good reasons for the Rafale is quite strong. Yet they appear to be reluctant to go over, you know, slightly under two per month, which is extraordinary. I can't imagine that people will succeed in getting them to go to higher rates than two per month. Because remember, this is the most Franco-French program in history, and indeed French fighters are truly, other than Russia, I don't know of anyone else who's quite so monocultural. You know, you'd have to get SNECMA and Thales on board and all of the French contractors to agree to make capacity expansion plans that they might be reluctant to do. Because, you know, for the first couple of decades, this was a one-a-month program at best. So no one wants to be stuck with 100% more capacity than they need if things turn south.
And obviously, right, this production rate decision is driven by the fact that older Rafale jets are going to be going to Greece as part of the purchase, and the French Air Force wants to buy new jets in its inventory. Sash, anything you want to add to this before we go to Rheinmetall and we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, just I completely agree with Richard's summary there. What I would highlight is it's not just that it's a very Franco-French aircraft, and that the, you know, he's absolutely right about it. The production system is incredibly single nation, and there are a lot of mom and pop shops involved there. So it doesn't have big subcontractors who are doing huge sections of, you know, the fuselage or whatever else. It's got a lot of very, very small companies who are reluctant to increase capacity, you know, for what may only be 2 or 3 years. But I think also what we're seeing is, you know, Dassault is essentially a private company that happens to have a stock market quote, and it behaves like a private company. They are thinking 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years ahead and thinking, we don't want to risk overexpansion now if that's going to damage what we're doing in the late 2030s, 2040s, 2050s, which is commendable. But it's still, you know, I think if I were Florence Parly or the French CDS, I'd be deeply frustrated that just at a time when Rafale seems to be on a real roll. And I can't help feeling that they feel they're with a better chance in Finland. I mean, you know, our view has been that Switzerland is in the bag for them, but they seem to feel that they're with a better chance in Finland, plus, you know, smaller countries like Croatia. And that's why they want to put the production rate up to 3 a month.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I once interviewed Serge Dassault, and he was one of the greatest conversations that I've had with an aerospace or defense leader. And what I thought was utterly fascinating was, you know, that he said, look, if you've got a great team, always make sure you preserve the team. The people are the thing. And you guys, you know, surge production up, surge production down, drop people, rehire, get shorthanded, and we raise talent and keep talent and, you know, don't shift gears every 2 years for what the market has to say, which I thought was kind of an admirable thing. And again, part of the core philosophy of the company, because I know Eric Trappier learned, you know, with Charles Edelstein and with Serge Dassault. You know, I do see that being a factor in their strategic calculations all the time. Sash, really quickly, talk to us about Rheinmetall in the 30 or so seconds we've got left.
Yeah, I mean, look, Rheinmetall is arguably Germany's only world-class defense or aerospace business. And I realize it's a very provocative statement to make. Probably in aerospace, actually, to be fair, MTU in aero engines. But certainly in defense, Rheinmetall is the world-class business in land systems, you know, weapons, ammunition, armored vehicles. And the really interesting thing about Rheinmetall in recent years is they've spent their own euro on developing their own armored vehicles. And the Lynx, which is a very heavy mechanized infantry combat vehicle, I mean, you know, it's thick end of 40% bigger in pretty much every dimension than a Bradley, and far more heavily armored and armed than a Bradley. Entirely private venture, and they you know, won a major contract in Hungary the other week. And that's starting to change the entire balance of Rheinmetall. You know, it's becoming an exporter of armored vehicles rather than a domestic producer of weapons and ammunition for Germany. The frustration, I think, for some investors with Rheinmetall is it's also got an automated components business, which was, investors could tolerate that when the auto markets were okay, but they turned tough over a year ago. Then you had COVID, and the business has had a really tough year. And Rheinmetall's restructuring is just, and sort of strategic options have been underwhelming. You know, they said, oh, we'll sell a bit of the pistons business off, but they're going to keep the rest of it. And therefore, again, you know, we talked about the Italian discount and Leonardo. What you've got here is a conglomerate discount, that it's a world-class defense business trading below fair value because it's got an automotive business that investors just don't want at the moment. And I think it's going to be very interesting. Their Q3 results are out in a couple of weeks' time. It's going to be really interesting to see how they address that, because I get the feeling management have been getting a lot of criticism from investors about that in the last, in recent months.
And Richard, any wrap-up thoughts as we end for the week?
You know, I really am just struck with the sort of, I guess, K-shaped recovery that Boeing is showing. That's the theme for the week. International domestic markets, K-shaped recovery, Boeing, K-shaped recovery. Yeah, they did really well with the 737 MAX, which of course is key to their short-term financials. But in terms of their long-term disposition, another dismal step downward, the downward leg of the K. So increasingly, that K-shaped outlook is kind of the metaphor for our times, I'm afraid.
And speaking of K shape in about 10 seconds. Now that EASA has certified, we've got FAA coming up. When do we expect the Chinese? And is there any change in your rate assumptions? Like, do sales surge suddenly, right? I mean, here and there, they've been sold as freighters and two here, two there and stuff like that. But I mean, nothing really needle moving.
I think it's going to be very hard for the Chinese to hold out for whatever reason, trade negotiations, what have you, for more than, 3, 4, 5 months. Obviously, politics are involved there, so all bets are off. But I think they're going to look like the odd one out. And, eventually they're going to, hopefully they'll lead the way in the air travel recovery. So their airlines are going to need this plane, at least in some numbers. So I expect to see them within 6 months. In terms of selling the plane, that's another story because, you've had a significant reduction in the MAX backlog over the past year, especially because, contractual terms allow people to get out of this. So they're going to cancel a plane. It's going to be this one because there's no penalty. And the other problem is that, they've got to deliver 450 jets that were already built. And they say they're going to do that all next year. Not likely, but that's what they say. Which means you're not going to see rates get above 20 per month anytime in the next couple of years, given market demands, given the existing overhang of things. Beyond that, it'll be a successful program, but that's going to take some time.
Sash?
I'm less optimistic about the ability of the MAX to recover, actually. I think given that it's a single model now, or a single, competent model, the Dash 8, and I think airlines that have it on order will take it reluctantly. But I think the idea there's going to be a boom in new orders. Yeah.
If I could just quickly agree with that and also point out, bringing it home to your metaphor, Vago McDonnell Douglas, they did their best to take the MD-90, their last single aisle jet, and do something more with it rather than the baseline model. And they kind of failed. And I am afraid that fate kind of haunts the 737 MAX 8 because the 9 and 10 aren't looking so great. And they really need to rethink their single aisle product line philosophy.
Great, guys. Thanks so very, very much. Really appreciate it.
Cheers. Have a great week.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Paco. Bye-bye.
Bye. And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.